You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists who spent time on call. And this week I bring you a conversation I had with Jason Schuster of Stratasan. Jason has been in tech for about 20 years, and he landed his first job admiring some HP UX servers. He took a low salary and really went in for some of the training, and ended up helping companies implement DR, worked in internal systems for government contracts for like 13 years, and now he's working at Stratasan, and he's working on some really interesting things around Terraform and other cloud services. So Jason found me pretty much the same way I tell you all you should find me, and that's just send me an email. And it's really easy. Just send an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com or send me a tweet at oncallnightmare or at jdestro. So next week, you'll be able to find me at the DevOps Days in Portland. I'll be doing a talk very shortly, a nice quick Ignite. I'll be meeting with some people and having some conversations. I hope to be meeting with you and maybe doing an interview with you. I think that'd be really awesome. And if you'd like to be that person, you know, like I said, I'll be in Portland and be there for DevOps Days. I'm very easy to find. Email me, DM me, whatever it is. So that being said, let's get into our conversation with Jason as we get into what he's done in operations over almost 20 years. You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technicians who spend some time on call. And this week, you know, I always ask everybody, come to me, give me your stories, because there's no podcast without your stories. And, you know, it's not just for the people who are the big name CTOs and the CEOs. I know I try to get a lot of those stories, but that's because I am a high achiever. But I really want to hear from people who are currently ICs, who are currently involved in on-call rotations, and that are seeing what's going on. And that's what I got lucky that I got to speak with today, Jason Schuster. Jason Schuster works at Stratasan, and he's been involved in technology for what, about 13 years now?
Closer to 20.
Oh, closer to 20. Supporting our internal systems for government contracts for 13 years, but a career that's been involved in tech for about 20, correct?
Yeah.
That's awesome. So Jason, thank you for coming on to On-Call Nightmares. You know, one of the great things about this podcast is it's really as simple as you hear the podcast and you say, you know what, I got a story. And it sounds like you got some stories, but let's learn a little bit about you. Sound cool?
Yeah, totally. I took a few years off before I went to college, and I got the mandatory best thing you can do for an IT career, which was a BFA in theater design, because, you know, theater degrees are really, and the best thing is, you can really sell that as far as being like, hey, I'm used to having a really tight deadline with a whole bunch of interdependencies and scheduling mm-hmm. through them and making sure everyone has the tools they need. So, yeah. You
know, I work with a woman named Chloe Condon, and Chloe, actually was a theater major and then was in theater before she came to tech. And one of the things that she likes to kind of promote is the fact that, you know, it's performance when you do a lot of the things that she and I do as developer advocates. So I greatly appreciate people coming from theater background.
Yeah. But I graduated in June of 2000. So, you know, right after the dot-com boom, because, hey, why not enter the workforce then?
Sure.
I was doing some like desktop support, like going to people's homes and replacing bits and pieces for IBM and doing Y2K compliance stuff. And I was able to swing an interview with a really big outsourcer, CSC, who no longer exist. They were contemporary to Accenture, is like how big they were.
Sure. So like an MSP or a managed service provider. So let me guess, you're like taking care of the big, big things for companies that they just didn't know how to do.
Yeah, my first contract was FASA on the web. So filling out your finance forms for the government. So I did a lot of stuff like that for them. And
so you were like, it looks like you had to deal with a 24/7 data center at that time.
Oh, yeah. So they got me really cheap, because they're going to train me, and they did train me well, and they sent me to a lot of really awesome HP classes. surprisingly, it wasn't the week-long ones that were great. It was the 2-day one on LVM that really like paid my bills for a long time, because knowing more about disk, how to do magic with disks and whatnot, was that used to be such something big, and now that's a skill that's mostly gone, is if you're in the cloud, because there's so rare
Sure.
do you actually interact with your disks.
RAID management is something that, to be honest with you, it's really now on the cloud architects or service, or I guess what you would call solutions architects, because your average administrator doesn't have to concern themselves with RAID levels and things like that anymore. It's not part of what we do.
Nope, you don't have to worry about two fiber channels going back to the SAN. The fiber channel switches between you and the SAN, working on all the addressing stuff. Yeah, none of that's a thing anymore. And it's interesting that it's not a thing anymore, except for that one day every 5 years that it is, and you're like, wait, I know this.
Yeah, when there's some sort of like kernel exception that has to do with the driver with a specific RAID card, and that one day where that one person that does enough kernel hacking figures it out and makes everyone cry. I know that day. So you worked there for about what? 10 years, huh?
13 years actually.
13, wow.
I remember they gave you the extra week of vacation at year four, and then the next one came at year 14, and I was just like, ha, that will never happen. And it was just about to happen when it was time to leave.
Sure. So then you move on and you go to a place called ICA. And where is this all located? Are you working remotely, or are you working in offices? How are you doing all this at this point?
I started off in Connecticut, and then I was working in DC, and then I started doing contracts local in DC after being remote from the team in Connecticut. I then virtualized everything, or I then moved everything out of DC to a different data center. And once that project was done, I'm like, hey, I'm leaving town. Do you want me to keep doing your stuff? And they said yes. And so I did probably, I think it was 8 or 9 years here in Nashville, just because I had friends here. And so yeah, everything thereafter is here in Nashville with a bunch of small places.
Gotcha. So now you move forward, you work a couple other jobs, and you start getting into working as a DevOps analyst, engineer, and you're part of places where you're on bringing them into the CI/CD world, and it sounds like kind of that's where you are at Stratasan now. You're assisting with like uptime on on-premise networking and helping companies with their SaaS applications, stuff like that.
Last gig, I was the only op person in the company for a while, and they eventually got more, but I was still taking care of their one SaaS app. So army of one, kind of being 24/7 on call, except for the fact that with it was a low volume application, so most people were using it during business hours or daylight hours, and most problems that didn't self-heal could wait until the morning. So
Gotcha.
that
So
was terrible.
how long would you say you've been on call, and what do you like, when was your first kind of like jump into it?
Well, right when I started my very first job in 2000, they were training me, and I was taking care of some of the dev systems. And then one of the senior admins left, and they handed me his machines and said, go play in traffic. And so it's been essentially, 20 years of carrying a pager of some kind or another. One of the things that led to me leaving there was teams roll, companies change. I was moved into a team of 12. When I left, I was on call 1 week in three. And
Gotcha.
that was part of what broke me on that one. So.
Yeah. The one thing that I learned that a lot of us who worked in operations for very long times is that we've seen the maturity of the on-call rotation. And it's actually been one of the things I think that saved a lot of us in certain places, that once you find a company that you're going to be a part of, their ops team, DevOps, whatever it is, that you really are searching for a mature on-call rotation or something that's a out of the sun or whatever it is, because it really makes a difference between whether you're sane or not in a week.
And whether or not everyone's on the page with you for triaging what calls come in and how they come in and who calls you why. Recently, one of the podcasts I listened to said something about if you get a page that's a no action, you do have an action, and that's turn off that page.
Mm-hmm. It's very important. I learned that so long ago.
Yeah, and it's funny in this day and age with all the automation, it's way easier to shut up alerts with your Nagios or whatever system you're using than it is to tell the knock center who's there with their 3-ring binder, and they're like, well, you know, it turned red. I know it says here not to call you, but it turned red, so I wanted to call you. And it's just like, dude, like, you're up at 3 a.m, I'm not.
Yeah, human process is one of the most difficult parts of, I guess, what you call like a DevOps transformation or a solid on-call rotation. Either way, it's just like you can write as many runbooks as you want, but people will still see that red dot and get scared by it.
Yep, absolutely.
So let's talk about being scared, and that's where you kind of take over the microphone for a little while. And you tell us a story about, you know, being on call and a nightmare, but before you do that, we got rules. And one of the coolest things I got to do recently is I got to do a talk at DevOps Days in Chicago, and I did it, and a little bit was mentioning this podcast, and I got to do the rules live. And it was fun. I got to go, so there are rules. And people were like, oh. And I'm like, yes, 3 rules. 1, do not incriminate yourself. Do not incriminate others, because we are blameless in all of our retrospectives. And 3, help us learn, because this podcast, like that talk I did, was a retrospective. So with that, Jason, I'd like to hear your on-call nightmare.
There are a few, but I think I'm going to go with that whole don't incriminate anyone else. And, you know, we do blameless retrospectives. And I'm going to give the negative example of why this is a great rule. Because usually the whole blameless retrospectives is to keep your teammates with you and the other parts of your organization with you, and you don't want to alienate anyone. And we're all learning and growing. And, you know, the whole point is not to have the same problem twice.
Mm-hmm.
So I just picked up all the finance systems from various coat closets and underneath people's desks in DC. And I had just moved them to a very modern, high-tech, high-availability data center, the type of data center that had 2 feeds running to 2 different directions out of there to 2 different power grids, et cetera, giant generator farms. And so I had just finished this. We're settling in. We're getting going. And then the data center goes dark. 100% power loss to an entire data center. And I actually had to drive from DC to Delaware to help turn on everything, you know, and also make sure things were coming up in the right order, because some servers turned right back on when power came back, but then the SAN obviously had a long way to come back up, because this was in the old days of the big EMCs and the bit.
Mm-hmm. And they would have to mount their LUNs and their mount points. And if they didn't mount properly, then you'd have file systems that were stale and you wouldn't be able to connect to them, and everything would suck.
Yeah. So the adventure of getting everything back up, running FSCKs on machines that had been up for 4 or 5 years,
mm-hmm.
like, that was all fun and games. But the part that really becomes, you know, the learning moment is the post-action report for all these clients, you know, a good chunk of the clients of the, you know, company in the U.S., the root cause analysis was, oh, a contractor was here, and they left this switch in a position this switch was not supposed to be left in, and at the same time, we had this thing, and the report literally said, a perfect storm, because that was, you know, a movie that had happened recently.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 weeks later, it happened again. Or it might have only been a week later, it happened again.
Same thing, switch out of position, something, something, or?
No, when they were coming back off, well, they'd already come back off generators. There was doing a generator test, and a generator test somehow produced the same result. It's been enough years that I don't recall the details. But so what are you going to tell your clients then? So if you'd had a blameless like resolution to that, then, you know, you wouldn't have as much egg on your face when it happens again, and you don't have someone to, you know, throw out for the lines and be like, oh, it's all his fault. Because the second time, you're obviously on the hook for it. So that's just an object lesson, and there's more than one reason to be blameless.
Yeah,
I had a CTO a long time ago during an outage that was actually caused by someone knocking a cable out. And it was one of those things where that person eventually got let go because it was like the third or fourth time they had done this kind of thing, blah, blah, blah. But the long story is that I got told to tell a story that had nothing to do with a person kicking a cable out. I got told to tell a story that had something to do about a line card. And it's amazing what sometimes people will do to help you make sure the customer feels comfortable. But a lot of times people don't understand the nonsense that goes on in ops. And a lot of times prior to, I think, super like awesome redundancy in systems, a lot of us were winging it. Yep. A lot of these things had to be blameless because it was too embarrassing at times to tell what really happened.
You mean like taking a week-long outage from the Windows guys because they decided to clean up the cabling to the rack and nothing was labeled correctly?
You know, I've worked in situations where it wasn't just like the one group of people, but like, you know, the hardest thing I've found, and especially with migrations are dealing with outages that have to do with like systems failing, is the fact that we don't document quite enough about our physical systems that they will easily return from an outage. At least we didn't, I think, about 10 years ago.
No, we certainly didn't. It might have been perfect the day of, but mm-hmm. the drift that inevitably happens when you swap out this one card or, oh yeah, this copper went bad and we swapped it out. Like the drift over time is, I think, the bigger killer of that, especially back then.
And like if places where you're talking about MSPs, where you're talking about hosting providers, where, you know, customers are expecting certain kind of responses to what it is you're doing. A lot of times there's no answer, like, or there's not a business acceptable answer that you can give to the customer. And one of the things that I really appreciate about where I'm at now is that, you know, working in a far more different culture than I did, you know, say 10, 15 years ago, is that, you know, when a thing happens, customers, I think, are more capable of recognizing that these failures occur and that they're building around it.
Yeah, and I think we have done better because now it's no longer like, oh, I'm looking at a black screen. I'm mm-hmm. looking at a comprehensible error page. I am going to their Twitter and checking for the status there. It's no longer falling into a black hole. And also, I think people have... I think back 10, 15 years ago, people were still used to IBM showing up in blue suits with, you know, the ties and being like, we're going to come here and save you and this thing will run forever and ever and ever. Mm-hmm. And the reality is once we started hooking things up to the internet, like that level of predictability plummeted. Mm-hmm. And it took a long, and it's taken until the modern cloud evolution for us to start being like, oh, we can now throw enough hardware at things that they're reliable. We're no longer, you know, serving millions of people with a single 1U server, and we don't have enough money for the second one. Or we don't have a way to fail to the second one, which was the reality for a long time.
Yeah, I think that's true because for a lot of time people were computing on the cheap because of the capital expenditure associated with getting on like started. And now the fact that we don't have to worry about that because we can say, what do you need? All right, here's a credit card. Let's just get going. Yeah. It's far different. So back to your story a little bit. I'm curious, throughout that period and eventually, did you find a long-term resolution to some of the issues that you were seeing with this particular incident?
With this particular incident, it was kind of out of my hands. It was purely a physical plant issue at the data center, mm-hmm. which I was remote to.
Sure.
It did help us explain to the internal clients why having disaster recovery, objective times, and time to point of failure and whatnot were so important. And that definitely helped shape our DR strategy going forward because now the client understood viscerally what those meant.
I think that's an important part of this story to tell, is that the fact that it led to DR is that I think that not enough people get that it takes till a failure occurs sometimes for organizations to recognize that disaster recovery needs to be part of what they're doing. And if they don't take that on early, then they'll have an outage that makes them recognize it needs to be part of their business continuity plan. And, you know, for those of us who've been in, you know, tech for a long time, the term business continuity plan is always one of those things that, you know, especially operations, you get thrown at you. And like, how are we going to continue running if X, Y, or Z goes down? And 10 to 15 years ago, you know, far more convoluted. But nowadays, it's amazing how we can, like, you know, well, we can just spin up this with Terraform, you know, turn up these VMs or have these containers, and then the database will restore and we'll be ready to go. You know, and we seem like that's an easy and programmatic thing to do. And I think that's one of the biggest differences, is it, it's much simpler to say failure can be resolved with code and other options, as opposed to, holy shit, we got to get more servers online.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's that, you know, back in the day, I would go to a vendor with a box of tapes that came back from our tape, our, you know, archive vendor. And I would sit there with a hunk of bare metal and, you know, a set of tapes. And like, one of the big things I brought to the DR procedure for our team was I made the recovery of our backup software way, way faster, way more efficient, to the point where I had the whole tape library and catalog online before people were done restoring their OS. Mm. And that was something that no one had taken ownership of. And it was this meandering, like, no one really understands the voodoo being done. And the nice thing is, in this day and age, it's way easier to spin up a VM, test the procedure for that sort of work, and have good confidence going in that it's going to work. The art of disaster recovery, like, at one point I had a net backup server that was doing an rsync to a sister server that was located in the disaster recovery facility, because we paid for a rack there. And so that made DRs even faster. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was also another hunk of stuff to maintain.
And that's ultimately which we're very, very lucky. We don't really have to be in that world now. So as we kind of start rolling to the end, one of the questions I'd like to ask you is, if someone's listening right now and they're on call, what's a piece of advice you could give them?
Thinking of all the sleepless nights. Keeping track of what you've solved so that when you see it again is amazingly handy. And I had a plain old TXT file with all my cheats and commands in it. And now that could be a OneNote, that could be a Git repo, that could be a unlimited number of things. But having that scratch pad will save your life, especially when you're bleary-eyed at 3 a.m. and you're like, oh, it's this thing again. And the nice thing is these days you can usually write have a script written for that triggers to run without you. And that's one of the cool things nowadays that we couldn't do back in the day, especially when you're dealing with more hardware failures than the sort of stuff we see now. And the other thing is, you know, keep an achievement doc. So when you get to that review time, like, you can say what you've done. And especially since most of us are doing ops type things, the things that you have caused not to happen and to make sure you keep track of that, because no one notices when the trains run on time. Of course, the trains run on time because they're trains. There were times that I got really angry because a different team was working really hard because all their stuff blew up and because they hadn't done all the pre-work. And I was on contingency plan 3, contingency plan 4, because I wasn't going to fail. And I wanted to make hit the timeline, hit the window. So I made sure my backup plans had backup plans for success, which is good habit to be in. But so they were getting the recognition for working hard, and no one commented on the fact that my stuff went way smooth. So
understand it.
Like keeping those things and those kind of advocacies for yourself.
Sure.
Real important.
Absolutely. So let's wrap up. Just to kind of tell everybody, if you have any, what are you kind of doing nowadays at, what is it, Strasada? I'm sorry.
Stratasan.
Stratasan, sorry. My apologies.
Doing incredibly boring things that we're all very happy about. We do business intelligence for hospitals to help improve their service to their client area. So obviously, you know, it's exciting. Pulses get high. But literally just, it's such a clean stack that when I came in, I'm like, oh, let me see if I can save money over here. Oh, that's $10. Oh, that's $20. So just continuing streamlining, continuing upgrading the Terraform, getting us off of bits of AWS that we don't really want to be on anymore, but we're kind of lashed to. So that's kind of what my day-to-day is these days. I've inherited a Jenkins server, which I am not a fan of, but, you know, that's life.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, Jason, thank you very much for being part of the podcast today. I really do appreciate it. How can people get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Probably best bet is either email jason@iamaunixadmin.com. Because, you know, vanity domains for work are great. I'm also on Twitter, and my work Twitter is DevOps Are Us. Is that what it is?
I believe so. DevOps Are Us.
Yeah.
All like the old, yep, like the old Toys Are Us. DevOps Are Us. So thank you very much, Jason. I really appreciate your time. We'll have to do this again and talk more about ops and all the things associated. So thank you for providing me with another nightmare for our collection.
All right. Thank you.
And we'll be right back to wrap things up. Well, thanks a lot, Jason. I really appreciate your time. You can find him on Twitter, DevOps R Us. And if you have any other questions, you can reach out to him directly by email. He gave his email, and I'm sure that if you have anything related to Stratasan, he'll be happy to answer it for you. So thanks a lot, and like I said, see me at DevOps Days Portland. We can talk, we can do this podcast together, whatever you want. Just reach out to me on email on callnightmares@gmail.com, or reach out on Twitter, it's @jdestro or @callnightmare. So we'll see you next week, where every week I have conversations with technologists who spend time on call.